and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
CBS News Brief. President Trump says when it comes to Russia's war on Ukraine, President Zelensky needs to agree. But Trump thinks there is a deal with Russia and says of meeting Putin.
I will be meeting
in Saudi Arabia.
It's possible, but most likely not. I think we'll meet with him shortly thereafter.
The body of the late Pope Francis is within St. Peter's Basilica to lie in state until Friday evening. Pilgrims, including John McKay of the UK, wait in line to pay their respects.
He taught us all how to be Christians and to be human. And that's what we are so happy about. So we'll follow him. And we want Pope Francis II now.
Steve McMichael played 15 years in the NFL and then came the big game in 1985 with the Chicago Bears.
Hungry Chicago, finally champions.
That call from the NFL, McMichael's publicist says the defensive tackle died today after a battle with ALS. He was 67. CBS News Brief, I'm Jennifer Kuiper.
Hi, this is Beth, inviting you to join me for The Kitchen's Open, the show within the show each Monday morning at 9 a.m. on The Morning Show on WFHR.
The Brewers blast the Giants. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports. Baseball last night in San Francisco. Top of the sixth. Bases loaded. Christian Yelich at the plate on FanDuel Wisconsin.
2-2 coming. Fly ball center field. Back goes Lee. He is still back. And it is gone. A grand slam for Christian Yelich opens this ball game wide open.
It was Yelich's first grand slam in 3 years. Milwaukee went on to win 11-3 over the Giants. A lot of contributions from the crew. Pat Murphy.
Terang sticks out. Yelich sticks out. Those guys were amazing. Bowers getting the start once in a while and hit a homer later in the game to keep adding on. A lot of good Durbin. A lot of good offensive performances today.
NBA, the Bucks losing to the Pacers 123-115. Indiana leads the series 2-0. Game 3 Friday night.
We'll just see. I'm very confident about this series. There.
At Stock Rivers with sports, I'm Mike Clemens.
The Maggie Dawn Show.
Check out my war plans.
Pete Hegseth talking about first big strike against the Houthis in Yemen on Signal, two separate channels. Yes, the one you heard about before with the reporter on it. Oops-a-daisy. And now also his wife, his bro, and his lawyer who magically got hired by the Pentagon. This guy's judgment could not be worse. Do you think Hegseth should probably resign?
The Maggie Dawn Show. Weekday afternoons, 4 until 6 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app. Locally grown radio, WFHR.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here today on the big program. Lots to get to, lots to talk about. Chaos abound. And actually, Pete Hegseth watch. Evidently, the all the arrows are pointing towards Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth finding the exit. Now, what I thought was interesting is Hegseth on Monday came out and said, you know, him and Trump, same page. On the same page. All that stuff. Yeah, not a big deal. Not a big deal. Things are... We're good. He said, I've spoken with the president, and we're going to continue fighting on the same page all the way. And then it was reported that White House Press Secretary Carolyn Leavitt, President Trump stands strongly, strongly behind Pete Hegseth. Strongly. Claimed that the criticism, that just happens. It happens when the entire Pentagon is working against you. Just happens. Never mind the mass dysfunction. Never mind the signal thing, you know, leaking sensitive operational plans. Never mind the mass firings. Never mind the general tanking of morale. No, no. It's just what happens when everyone's against you because you're an idiot. That's all I can come up with. I've never heard a good thing here. And from what the reports are now, that all of the stuff, that the firings, the leaks, the chaos, it's going to get worse. The affairs, I guess, right? It's going to get worse. Now, understand, you know, the stuff that's coming, they're going to do what they do. And, well, you know, just a bunch of hoaxers. You know, just a bunch of hit pieces. Just a bunch of, you know, how does Trump put it? How does Trump frame that? All a bunch of fake news. We then hear the news almost the same day that the White House is looking for a new defense secretary. And of course, they've got to. They've got to. In fact, he could be fired already. Could have happened by the time, from the time I record this until the time it airs. Could happen. And now you've got profiles in Courage like Don Bacon coming forward, who's on the House Armed Services Committee. Who, well, you know, he should go. He said, I had concerns from the get-go because Pete Hegseth didn't have a lot of experience. I like him on Fox, but he doesn't have the experience to lead one of the largest organizations in the world. That's a concern, he said. Yeah, you know when the time to voice that concern would have been? I don't know. Maybe before you named him defense secretary. Maybe this is why you don't go, we're going to give all of the power to one guy. Maybe this is why. And yes, I know Bacon's in the House. It's the Senate's job. But you know, if the House started, you know, screaming, maybe the Senate listens. Maybe the Senate does its job. Maybe by having a House that has a spine, the Senate might find it. We also find out that evidently our intelligence agencies, all 18 of them, have determined that the mass deportation plan that Trump has drawn up earlier this month, how did it go? That the Venezuelan government was directly invading the U.S. They were sending this prison gang here, and they were doing it on purpose because, you know, because that's the phrase, isn't it? This has been what they've done on immigration from the beginning, to tell the dim that foreign governments are just emptying their insane asylums and they're emptying their prisons and their policy. And yet, you know, what you see mostly coming across the border are women and children. I know women and children can be in gangs. When I was a kid, I was in a gang, a couple of them. Not like MS-13. I'm not admitting that. Now this is one of those things. We're in a world where, you know, I said, look, I was in a gang. We were in a little bicycle gang, because we were kids. That now, could that be used against me to deport me, throw me into an El Salvadorian prison? I fear it could, because that's where we're going. Now, the National Intelligence Council, you know, our intelligence agencies, the thing with Venezuela, BS. it's BS. There's nothing there. But the administration has laid all of their cards on that table. So what are they going to do? Well, we evidently need a reshuffling of that agency. There was a leaked memo, an executive order memo, that they were going to shake up the foreign services. You kind of got to wonder. Be afraid. And what comes of all of this chaos? Because look, it's fun to watch. It's interesting to watch as they're literally, you know, falling on their face. What does it mean to us? How bad does it get for us? We, the working people of this country, who honestly don't have the kind of wealth to weather a storm. The ones who are going to probably lose our homes to people like Donald Trump, who does have the wealth to weather the storm, or at least the credit. He's caused international chaos, even worse than what he's done here at home. And now you see the story of China coming out and saying, look, if you're a country that makes a deal with the U.S. and we view it to our detriment, we're coming for you. You know, Taiwan, Japan, South Korea, who have come and they've tried to negotiate with Trump. China's saying, hey, look, you bend the knee there, you got problems with us. And this is why bungling this so badly and why Mr. Art of the No Deal bungling this badly is going to harm working people. I said before, I think Joe Biden was doing it the right way. Slowly moving towards raising tariffs, protecting domestic industry with them, but also investing in things where we were bringing stuff back. Using government procurement to source domestically, because we need this. Learning the lesson from the pandemic. What was the first thing that China did when Trump raised his tariffs? What was it, 145% now? What was the first thing they did? They cut off rare earth minerals. Because during his term, we left that door wide open for him. We allowed China to walk in and do whatever they wanted in Africa. And we were too busy reading the most recent ridiculous tweet. And here we are again. A president who clearly has an ego that needs to be fed constantly and stoked constantly, and a foreign policy arm that's dysfunctional, a defense secretary that's seriously. And I remember people, you know, defending Hegseth. Oh, he was in the military. Yeah, you know, okay. You ever lead that organ? No. He was on Fox News, though. So that's a qualification. He slept at a hotel, except at one of those hotels, one of those express hotels that they ran the commercials that you're smarter because you stay there. These are the best and brightest. This is the best our country has to offer. Christy Noem, who gets her purse ripped off while surrounded by Secret Service and cameras, and they still can't find the guy. And these are the people that we entrust with all of our sensitive information. These are the people that we've handed the keys to the kingdom. These are the people that we've said, go ahead, run the country. So are we surprised when we said that they're going to run it into the ground? Are we surprised that bad things are going to happen? And that out of the chaos is going to come pain and suffering? Now, you could go, Rick, you know, you've been saying this is all planned, and I think it is. I think the chaos is plotted. I don't think each individual bit of chaos, I think they know, as long as there's chaos, we can then do the real goal, which is breaking the federal government and stealing from we the taxpayers. My thought, and one of the first things they're going to do is go after those federal workers. You know, those workers. When we come back, Daniel Horowitz from AFGE going to be here to share some thoughts on the attacks happening to his members. Back after this.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors, the American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
So if you missed Earth Day yesterday, you had AFGE members in Michigan out rallying, and I would argue protesting as well, saying, look, assaults on the EPA, assaults on the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, assaults on the U.S. Geological Survey, assaults on, you know, the people who kind of make sure we have an Earth worth passing on. They were out on Tuesday supporting the idea of Earth Day, as we all should have been. But here to share some thoughts on what those agencies mean, especially as they are under attack, their employees are under attack, and ultimately, I think we're under attack. That's why I've asked Daniel Horowitz to come share some thoughts. He's the acting director of legislation with the American Federation of Government Employees, AFGE. Daniel, thanks for taking time for us.
Nice to be on the show again, Rick.
So,
go ahead.
Walk me through this. I mean, you know, Earth Day, kind of a big deal in my view for folks across the country. The agencies that we look to help protect our environment, help protect our planet, ultimately help protect us under pretty substantial attack. And good on your members for being out in the streets and highlighting that fact.
Well, yes, good on our members. It's hard to believe, but the first Earth Day, I think it was in 1970, wasn't a particularly partisan thing. Actually, the EPA started under Richard Nixon. But unfortunately, now the idea that the Earth should be habitable for the next generation or two seems to be a point of partisan contention. I don't know why. Our members at the EPA and NOAA simply want to do their jobs in climate science, weather prediction, and protecting the environment from pollution and from greenhouse gases, and they ought to be able to do that. Instead, what we've seen from the Trump administration are widespread firings and basically disabling these agencies and trying to repeal all the good work that they've done.
So let me ask you this, and this is an opinion question, because, you know, it's isn't the Trump administration just opposed to the idea of the EPA and NOAA and the Geological Survey, or is it this just pure political payback because he somehow feels aggrieved that your members just did their jobs, followed the law, and didn't do all the crazy stuff he wanted done last time?
Well, probably a little of both, Rick. I don't think they believe in science, full stop, and we see that across the entire government. And I'm sure there's an element of payback as well for people who believe in that sort of thing, people who believe that we should be using renewable energy and not our dwindling supplies of fossil fuels, and people who believe that our food should be healthy, people who believe that we should look at how the Earth is changing and ensure that it's habitable years from now.
Yeah.
So I think it's both.
Yeah, we're probably somewhere in the same age bracket. I remember the 70s, you know, growing up in Cleveland, which was in the manufacturing hub of the country. The pollution was crazy. The lake was filthy. You know, I say often I grew up in the home of the Clean Water and Clean Air Act. I don't want my children, my grandchildren, future generations to have to grow up in that environment. So when I see these attacks on the EPA, and I know you've got the Michelle Bachmans and the Republicans going, oh, job killer. I think about, you know, not so much of the job killing regulations that they throw us, which isn't true, but the people killing lack of regulation that I fear is coming down the pike.
Yeah, their approach is a little bit schizophrenic, isn't it? They seem to believe there is some role of pollutants in causing childhood diseases and so forth. But on the other hand, they just want to unshackle these polluters from any government oversight. You grew up in Cleveland. Cleveland was the birthplace of modern environmentalism, was it not, with the Cuyahoga River catching fire and leading to the Clean Water Act. It used to be you couldn't get elected from either party unless you said you wanted to clean up the environment. Enough time has passed, and these agencies have been so successful. I don't think people remember what it was like in the 1960s and before, when industries would just pollute wherever they wanted.
And in defense of my birth city, because I'm going to defend Cleveland, it could have been any city across this country where the water caught on fire, because everyone was polluting at that kind of a rate. It just happened to be unlucky enough to happen a couple of times there and on the Cuyahoga, because the conditions were such, because they had such large steel production and such. So in their defense, could have happened anywhere.
Absolutely. Cities across the country were routinely dumping raw sewage into the water at that time, and it was perfectly permissible until the Clean Water Act was passed. Under Nixon.
And that's the weird thing, because, you know, yesterday we talked about Nixon. You know, the fact that, you know, I'm not a crook, and if the president doesn't, it's not illegal. This is the same guy who EPA, OSHA. Wow. And now you've got this, where they're just saying, well, if you question the president, you're the crook, which is just bizarre. And here we are now undoing that legacy. So, you know, I also see your members as that firewall that has to be destroyed in order to get to this next place. So when I see these folks out in the street, I'm happy to see this. Now, I did want to ask you, because we spoke yesterday on the program with Phil Glover, one of your international vice presidents, about what happened at OPM on the Friday prior, which is they're reviving Schedule F, which supposedly they weren't going to do, which supposedly was part of Project 2025, which wasn't their playbook. What's going on?
Yeah, so during the campaign, Trump said knew nothing about Project 2025. I think we all know how truthful that statement was. So Schedule F was something he tried to put in place late in his first term to make thousands of federal employees basically at will. And of course, the ones he's most worried about are some of the same people we're just talking about, environmental scientists, other kinds of experts, people who, in his view, have some policy agenda that doesn't agree with where he is. So he wants to get rid of, in his view. So what he's done is OPM has put in place a proposed rule to bring back Schedule F. It's now called Schedule PC, but it's the same idea. Something like 50,000 federal workers who are in career jobs, who are experts hired for their expertise, would now be at will and could be fired simply for lack of loyalty.
And so in essence, we're
going
to
concert with everything else he's doing, it's really threatening the destruction of the whole civil service.
So in essence, he's making patronage great again.
Yeah, absolutely.
And how is that going to help us? And all of this stuff I look at, Daniel, through the lens of our government's supposed to do the things that we need done, the things collectively that we want that we can't individually do, like have clean air and clean water. How does this help us, we the citizens, the air breathers and the water drinkers? How does this help us at all?
It doesn't help it. It harms all of us. Look at the measles outbreaks happening in Texas. Look at the threat to remove fluoride, one of the most successful public health interventions of the 20th century. Remove it from drinking water and rot kids' teeth. Look across the board at what they're doing by attacking science and expertise, and how it's going to harm the American people. And Schedule F and all they're doing in this regard is just part of a campaign, I guess, to make people suffer. But the sooner we get past it, the better.
The election's a year and a half away, so this is going to be a long, long road, which I know you're, in speaking with your members and leadership, you guys are clearly up for, because, well, you have to. You're the last line of defense to democracy, I believe, at this point. And that, I got to tell you, that frightens me, because I don't think there's any length that they're going to go to stop to get their way.
No, they won't. And lately, they've ratcheted up their attacks on the unions themselves, because labor is one of the last things standing in their way. And on March 27th, Trump issued an executive order doing something that he never did in his first term, which is declare that most of the government is engaged in national security work. And under an obscure provision of what's called Title V, he can say no unions in government. I think we know why he's doing that, because unions have been going into court with a lot of success and slowing down some of his misguided ideas. So in his theology, he thinks it would be a good idea just to get rid of labor altogether. It would be much easier to enact his plans. So that is a body blow to AFGE. It takes 2/3 of our members out of commission. We're trying to sign them up again ourselves outside of government through what's called EDUs. But meanwhile, this harms unions greatly. And make no mistake, public sector unions are just the first to come under attack. If he's successful here, he'll certainly try to do the same thing to private sector.
Oh, it's everybody. Everybody's in the fish tank. It's just a matter of when you're going to be the flavor of the month. What other attacks? We've seen the attacks on TSA Officers have seen their collective bargaining rights taken away. As you said, the executive order making what, almost 200,000 of your members under some national security headline, taking their collective bargaining rights away. What else is coming?
Well, what else is coming is the Trump tax cuts, which will primarily benefit the wealthy if they go through. And they will harm a lot of other people because, in his view, some part of these tax cuts need to be paid for. Of course, Republicans love to wring their hands over the deficit. So they have all kinds of cuts that they're cooking up to pay for tax cuts. And one of these is $800 billion against Medicare, a program that benefits 80 million people who don't have the means to afford health care.
Yeah,
so that's going to be one of the big fights over the next month over these tax cuts and how to pay for them. And he has designs on federal employees, too. He wants to cut our members' pensions and health insurance to help pay for these tax cuts, primarily for the rich.
So basically, again, I go back to, you know, how does this help we, the working people? And it clearly does not. So, you know, the weird thing to me is there's still people out there who are cheerleading this. There are people who are cheerleading Trump going after your members. There, you know, Doge Boy and his little ferrets, you know, attacking, you know, government and wanting to privatize and profitize. You know, how does any of this destruction benefit us again? And I know the answer is it's rhetorical. It doesn't. But I think we have to be asking ourselves that over and over again. Is this what we voted for? Is this what we want? And ultimately, is this what eventually we want to happen to us and our families?
Well, that's something that every voter is going to have to consider on their own. But I think in the meantime, we have to look at what are the effects of what he's doing. What are the effects of closing Social Security offices, of laying off thousands of Social Security workers whose only job is to make sure that our seniors and the disabled get their benefits on time? What is going to be the effect of firing 80,000 people at Veterans Affairs? And is this going to help our veterans get the health care that they need after exposure to chemicals while fighting overseas? No, it isn't. So, and we can look at tariffs and all of his other issues and ask the same question. How will it benefit the average person who's simply trying to eke out a living? So those are the questions before us. Every person is going to have to answer for themselves in the next election. But, you know, what is happening to federal workers right now, which is so extreme, the firings, the rifts, the harassment, it's happening to federal workers now, but it will happen to other Americans down the road if federal workers aren't there to help enforce the laws that are on the books.
Now, I saw week before, the AFL-CIO and a number of unions, and I believe AFGE was part of it, forming this Rise Up, this Federal Workers Legal Defense Network. You know, my first thought was, well, about time. Something I had said you should have had one labor movement law firm that does all this stuff. Any thoughts on you know, how successful this can be? Because you know, the court is where we're going to have to fight this first battle. But ultimately, I think you're going to have to go to the streets because I don't think this administration is going to abide by any court rulings to begin with. But this has to be part of that. Do you have any thoughts?
Well, the legal defense, the Rise Up, is a great first step. Of course, the best thing for workers who are eligible is to join a union so that the union's lawyers can help defend them in proceedings. But it's a critical first step for sure. So many workers contact us, and some may not be union members. Some may not be in bargaining units. Some may be supervisors. They're all being mistreated by this administration. They're all being driven out on a rail. So everybody needs all the help they can get. And it's certainly fortunate that some lawyers who haven't yet been intimidated by this administration are willing to stand up to their actions.
Yeah. And well, and the last line of questioning I've got for you, because, you know, it seems to me that now is a great time to be going back to the people who were non-members and people who don't know anything about unions and go, hey, it's going to get worse. Time to find that S word, trying to find that solidarity, that unity to help weather this storm, because it's only going to get worse as the days and weeks and months go by.
Well, absolutely. And there's been a great deal of solidarity across the AFL-CIO on this issue. I think other unions see perfectly well what's happening. Remember that on day one, Trump's first action was to fire a Democratic member of the National Labor Relations Board, as well as other similar officials. We know where he's headed on this. We know what he will do to labor if he gets his way. And it just happens that public sector unions have the highest density of any unions, and they're the most exposed to executive action. Yep. So, of course, we're just the first in the firing line.
Daniel Horowitz, I appreciate you sharing some thoughts. Keep up the fight. Keep up the good work. And by all means, come back and keep us informed on what's going on.
Sure, will do. Nice to be on the show, Rick.
Thanks so much, Daniel. You got questions, thoughts for Daniel? By all means, afge.org. There's the website. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com, and we'll get those passed along. I want to hear your thoughts. Are you up for the fight? Do you see them as just the first? Do you see yourself in line? I want to hear it. rick@thericksmithshow.com. Right back.
You're listening to locally grown radio, WFHR, Rapids Home for Mornings with Pat Kreitlow.
You can always continue the conversation on social media. Share your thoughts when you find and follow Civic Media on Facebook, X, and Instagram.
I'm meteorologist Mace Michaels. Mostly cloudy for tonight, maybe a shower or two and a low in the mid-40s. Showers developing, especially tomorrow afternoon, high in the low 60s. Early showers, then clearing sky for Friday, highs in the mid-50s, and more sunshine Saturday, highs low 60s. Currently at 64 degrees.
Hey everybody, glad you could join us. I'm Tim Hubbelt, better known as the Polka Guy, on the Sunshine Polka Party Variety Show.
Join Tim every Saturday and Sunday for a great variety of polkas, waltzes, and more. Wake up at 7 a.m. on Saturday morning to get the weekend started on the right foot, then enjoy a lively Sunday afternoon at 1 p.m. Same great show, two different times, one fun weekend. The Sunshine Polka Party Variety Show, 7 a.m. Saturdays and 1 p.m. Sundays, only on WFHR, locally grown radio.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
You know, we're living through a time right now where, you know, looking back to the past and seeing how our grandparents' generation built what was the most prosperous working class in history, not a bad idea. Which is why I've asked Sean Richmond to come share some thoughts with us. You know, he's the author of Tell the Bosses We're Coming, A New Action Plan for Workers of the 21st Century. You know that book. Well, he's got a new one out. We Always Had a Union, the story of the New York Hotel Workers Union of a past era. Sean, thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks for having me.
So, I loved the first book. Thought it was an important book. Everyone should read it. This one, kind of historic. What made you go this route?
This is a passion project I've been working on for over 20 years. I used to work for this union. The union today is Local 6 of HERE, or Unite Here. The New York Hotel Trades Council is the larger umbrella. And there was a legend that we told ourselves about a former president of ours who got arrested at the union office and deported for being a communist. And that just seemed crazy, particularly like, you know, we were campaigning for Republican George Pataki's reelection as governor. So the idea that we had these communist roots was nuts. But I started researching it in grad school at UMass, and I figured out that there was really something here. And then it just needed the FOIA request to the FBI to take the decades that they would take to follow through. But basically, the story is, this is a union that has its roots in an IWW-style independent union that went on a series of strikes in the years 1912 and 1913, and continued to have an independent existence. There's a few different unions, but a clear lineal succession. They were day one joiners of the Communist Party. They were possibly, as the Amalgamated Food Workers, they were possibly the largest outpost of communist influence in the labor movement, certainly outside of the garment industry. And a lot of the fights that happened within both the Communist Party and the labor movement over strategy, over boring from within the AFL or going independent, over Stalin versus Trotsky, were all fought out within this union as well. The union winds up essentially negotiating its way into an AFL-CRAFT union, the Hotel and Restaurant Employees Union, where that union was dealing with basically mobsters in New York, and the only way they could get rid of them was the communists had the members. The communists had the organizers. They could out-organize them. And they did. And as a result of multiple citywide strikes that these unions ran, 1918, 1934 was a particularly ugly one with three different unions duking it out for supremacy. The hotel industry, with a lot of arm twisting from Mayor LaGuardia and others in the power establishment, agreed to a neutrality card check agreement, which is how the hotel industry got organized. And so my book covers that era from 1912 till 1953, when Michael J. Obermeyer is deported. And you know, its relevance is, sadly,
check the newspaper. No, I mean,
yeah, no, I mean, I didn't intend for it to be this timely, but it is. And you know, it tells a story of a union that experimented with strategy, with tactics, that did not doggedly pursue the same old, because that's the way it's always been done, that operated in an era of lawlessness and behaved accordingly. With stink bombs, with acts of sabotage, with tremendously violent picket lines sometimes. And then when the bosses were ready for peace, they worked out a system of industry-wide bargaining and industry-wide dispute resolution that brought peace to the hotel industry in New York. There was only one more citywide strike. That was 1985, and there hasn't been one since then. It's a very stable form of collective bargaining, but it could only be produced through the chaos of a bunch of anarchists and communists going at the bosses for several decades.
Yeah, the first thing I wrote down is you've lost everyone at communists, because we've been trained like Pavlovian dogs to, anytime you hear that word, to run screaming. And the reality is the communists were by far the best organizers. And, you know, to the point that you were making about the chaos, my grandparents, you know, told me of those fights that they were engaged in as they were fighting for dignity and respect on the job. And you're right. You know, the country at the time, especially during the time that you were talking about, was a violent, dangerous time.
So communists get both romanticized and vilified in a lot of labor history, and I wanted to do neither. So I try really hard in the narrative to just take them on their own terms. I just pursued the story like a journalist would. What happened? And so, you know, there are decisions that are made and courses that are taken that are bold and innovative and brilliant. And then there's some real dumbass moves. There's some really divisive stuff. One example is this union, the Amalgamated Food Workers, was in the early 1920s, was working with a bunch of other independent unions, many of them with the word amalgamated. Trying to form a new federation of independent unions. And they had about 60,000 members. They had shoe workers. They had auto workers. They had a lot going on there. I think that they would have become bigger than the IWW, a sort of a pre and proto CIO, if it wasn't for the Communist Party coming in and saying, you know, Vladimir Lenin and William Z. Foster both think that we should be inside the AFL contesting for power there and not running independent unions. There was a major battle over there, major ideological battle, where ultimately the independent unionists were convinced to shut down this labor unity council they had created. But the Amalgamated Food Workers won for themselves an exception to Comintern policy, where basically said, look, we're the real hotel workers union in New York. The Hotel and Restaurant Employees Union is a bartender's union. Division. They got nothing. We've got, you know, 10,000 members. We're the legitimate union. And they said, fine, you are, but, you know, don't antagonize them. Fast forward 6 years later, and the Comintern totally switches gears and says, get out of the AFL. We want to have total war with liberals and with social democrats. It's the third period. And made this union tear itself apart all over again. And, you know, very divisive period. There's a number of us as scholars were revisiting what was called the Trade Union Unity League, the independent federation that the communists created, 1929 to 1935. Saying, you got to measure it by strike activity, by activists that were left behind in the shops that wound up being crucial to the Steelworkers Organizing Committee and UAW campaigns later on. But the actual experience of it was incredibly divisive. And one of the things that I was surprised to see, I go into this wanting to know, all right, who was the rat? You know, who was talking to the FBI about Obermeyer? And I was able to find out exactly who they were. And it was amazing how much they went right back to 1929. So we're talking 1946, 1947. They're still pissed off about 1923 and 1929. And go in the AFL, get out of the AFL, the sort of the seesaw effect, which was really frustrating to a lot of activists and was incredibly polarizing.
And, you know, a lot of this stuff, you know, could be modern day tales, as you just saw the SEIU going back into the AFL, or where they had gone away. This stuff doesn't just stay static, does it? You know, we're living the history that in 50 years, somebody's going to look back at this moment and critique how badly or well the movement has responded to Trump.
And I mean, I think one of the things that this moment actually kind of calls for, I'll give a shout out to Eric Blanc and his book, looking at sort of startup unions, his book, We Are the Union. You know, a lot of historians take a dim view of independent union efforts, mainly because you got to go where the resources are. You got to go where the workers are. But if the mainstream unions are just not organizing, if they're refusing to spend their money and help workers organize, well, then you need something else. And so the Emergency Workers Organizing Committee, DSA, the UE, we're sort of, I guess, the main activists right now in this space of the IWW, even in this space of organizing independently where AFL-CIO unions won't for whatever reason. That turns out to be really important right now. I think one of the main lessons of We Always Had a Union, though, is don't get religion about it. It's what's practical right now. Right. And right now, you know, if you're at Trader Joe's, well, the independent Trader Joe's union is what's practical. If the UFCW were to start pouring millions of dollars into organizing, you know, Walmart again, well, that would make sense as an activist.
No, because, you know, I had a conversation, you know, a while ago on another radio program that I had done. And I said, look, you know, there was a time where, you know, virtually every trade had a union, waitresses and bartenders, and you go down the list, insurance agents, they all did, and they all had independent unions. And a lot of times they started their own unions because someone had asked, you know, how do I start my own union? I said, you know, get your coworkers together and figure out what it is that you want. That's the first step. And I was chastised for it by going, no, you just call the, you know, this union or that union. I'm going, yeah, but if you wanted to start something in your workplace, that's the first step, organizing people in your workplace together and figure out what it is you want and need.
If you can organize your coworkers, the unions will follow you. It has to start right there, worker to worker, one-on-one in the workplace for sure. But you need resources. So, you know, certainly call your local Central Labor Council, call the local unions, but also call EWOC and call the IWW. Just, you know, reach out and see who responds and who helps out.
So I want to go back to the guy who was deported, because, you know, we're now living in a moment where, you know, you go back to Pastor Niemöller's quote, first they came for the socialists and I said nothing because it wasn't the socialists. And then they came for the trade unionists and, well, you know, the rest of it. Do we foresee, given the fact that, you know, we saw Mr. Garcia being sent out of the country, we're having a conversation whether due process should apply in any of this stuff. Is this something that's our future, as is our past?
It is something that should terrify us all, and it's something that we have to eventually learn the lessons of. I wrote this for In These Times. As I was working on the book, I took a small piece of this out because I really wanted to understand Mike Obermeyer's story. And I was like, you know, because you read his FBI file, and these things are really fascinating, FBI files, right? Because you read the first couple of, they're sort of iterative and they're chronological. So you get the first report, and the first report is usually pretty dumb. Somebody going, oh, this guy's a communist. Okay, we'll look into it. The initial investigation is almost laughable. It's like, you know, oh, well, we went into the Commodore Hotel and we saw a copy of the union's newspaper, and yep, he's still the president. file that away, you know, and you're just like, ah, this is just the dumbest cops ever. And then, but then suddenly it gets real where like they actually get the information, like, whoa. And they've got, he was on this boat in 1933 and he didn't file the right paperwork. And we know he went, he had a false passport and this, that, and the other. And I was looking at all of these FBI files from these hotel activists. And Mike Obermeyer first arrives around 1916, 1917. He's a German. He can't go back to Germany. England doesn't want him. It's the war, right? It's not a great time for him. He never applies for, well, he applies for citizenship very, very, very late. And one of the reasons must be that he knows he would be in the jackpot because he was traveling in and out of the country on Comintern business. So he's a non-citizen, and he is put on the FBI's list and the Department of Justice's list and INS list as one of the most dangerous foreign, you know, alien enemies, basically. That they're like, if we start with the deportation drive, we go after him. Jay Rubin, who was the president of the Hotel Trades Council, Mike Obermeyer's partner, and a labor statesman by this point, naturalized citizen. He immigrates in 1923 and he gets his citizenship papers 1928-1929. They look at that and they go, well, you know, if he lied about being a communist when he applied for his citizenship paperwork, we can revoke it and then we can deport him. He's put on the list. It's a little bit more dicier because they're like, well, he is this labor statesman. He is a citizen, even though we think he shouldn't be a citizen. And then this woman, Gertrude Lane, who was the union's organizing director, who, you know, in the FBI file, they think that she's on the National Committee of the Communist Party. She isn't, but they think she is, which you would think would make her a very dangerous person in their eyes. But born in America, born and raised in New York City, Hunter College graduate, they just leave it to the New York office to keep tabs on her. That there was this sort of hierarchy of the importance of citizenship that the federal government was looking at. And that still exists. And one of the, you know, I wrote in these Times piece several years ago, when Trump was still president the first time, I said, the minute we get this guy out of office, we have to treat the next president like they're Trump and take away all of these powers that no one person should have.
Right.
Because citizenship doesn't mean anything if you can pull it away. We can't have tiers of citizenship. You're a part of this country. You're a part of the civic fabric. Or you're completely vulnerable to getting disappeared. And that's the lesson of Michael J. Obermeyer.
No, and it's an important one, given the fact that we're now debating due process and whether it applies to everyone. The Supreme Court's going to hear the birthright citizenship case. All this stuff is on the table, it seems.
It is, and it will be on the table. We have to. It's a 1798 law. It's time to repeal it. It was a bad law at the time. You know, it's one of these things where we go entire decades where presidents pretend it doesn't exist, but it's always there in case they want to go after their enemies. That's a crazy way to run a government.
That is a crazy. Last question I've got for you. What are you hoping? I mean, you've done an incredible job of research, an extensive job. What are you hoping people take from this?
Gosh, there's a lot in here. I mean, even on a granular level, I'm looking forward to, I'm somebody who, I enjoy Wikipedia, but I don't participate in it. And there are all of these Wikipedia pages or even just stubs where as I'm researching, I'd go and I'd see, oh, somebody got started on this, but they only know half the story. I'm just looking forward to Wikipedia editors taking this book and going, all right, no, the Food Workers Industrial Union, there was a lot more going on there. It wasn't just cannery workers in Kansas. It was also this part of it. That's a huge part of it. I'm looking forward to working, hopefully, with the Hotel Trades Council on doing some member-to-member education about their history. You know, I have hopes that this book, you know, if I wrote it well, I wrote it as a story. So it's not as academic feeling of a book. It tells a story. It's a narrative. And if I did a good job, you know, I hope that this is one of the go-to books for understanding labor in the first half of the 20th century. And I hope that this is a go-to book for understanding the New York labor movement. And I hope that it's a go-to book for understanding the Communist Party in the labor unions during its heyday.
And maybe also a cautionary tale of where we've been and maybe where we don't want to go back to.
also that, and you know, hopefully there's some, you know, I hope that people can draw some inspiration for you know, some of the tactics we can take. You know, I've put a little bit of a heavy thumb on this point occasionally, but if we lose the National Labor Relations Act, because that winds up before the Supreme Court and they overturn it, and we're in an environment where there's no such thing as protected concerted activity. Well, if everything is the same level of risk, why do you keep doing the same safe stuff? And I think it's worth looking at how hotel waiters and cooks engaged in sabotage as a routine part of their union organizing back in the day.
Well, most certainly something I hope people will take a look at. We always had a union by Sean Richmond. We'll get links out on social media how you can take a look at that. Sean, great work. I look forward to talking to you again for your next book.
All right. Thank you.
Thanks so much. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Remember, We Always Had a Union, the book by Sean Richmond. We'll get links out on social media so you can pick that up. Quick break. Right back. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1956. That was the day of the founding of the Canadian Labor Congress. Today, the Canadian Labor Congress is the largest labor organization in Canada, representing some 3.3 million workers. During the early 1950s, labor leaders in Canada were becoming increasingly uneasy about the rising influence of big business in the country. They knew that labor must stand united as a force representing the interests of workers for safe job sites and fair wages. In 1953, the country's two major labor organizations decided to form a unity committee. The Trades and Labor Congress of Canada had been focused on craft unionism, much like the AFL in the United States. The Canadian Congress of Labor emphasized industrial organizing, similar to that of the CIO in the U.S. The goal of the Unity Committee was to promote cooperation between these two Canadian labor groups and explore a possible merger. In 1955, labor leaders from the United States also recognized the importance of union solidarity to stand as a counterweight to the rise of big business in the U.S. The AFL and CIO merged. The next year, the Canadian merger was also complete. In Canada, the early Canadian Labor Congress had strong representation among manufacturing, transportation, and mining workers. Later, they organized more public sector workers, such as postal workers, nurses, police, and firefighters. By the late 1990s, the Canadian Labor Congress represented 2.5 million workers from 51 different unions. Each year on April 28th, the Canadian Labor Congress holds a National Day of Mourning. The day is set aside to remember all of the Canadian workers killed on the job. In the 1950s, labor solidarity was on the march on both sides of the Canadian border.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
Again, the book, We Always Had a Union, the New York Hotel Workers Unions, the story from 1912 to 1953. Well worth the read. And one of those things that I was fortunate enough to know a lot of old-time organizers, a lot of old-time labor people who shared the stories. I always thought a lot of the stuff was, well, yeah, as you get older, you start to embellish a little bit. Maybe you remember things a little differently. You know, maybe the explosion was a little bit bigger. Maybe it's a little more than what it really was. But you start reading the actual history and you're like, no, these guys were telling the truth. There was chaos in the streets because you had a situation where people were working to just not starve and fortunes were being made. You know, you came out of, you know, what today's MAGA world believes is the golden age of the American economy, which was the Gilded Age, where you had the, you know, the Rockefellers, the, you know, the Carnegies, you had the really stinking rich people, kind of like we got today. You got the Elon Musks, who, you know, the Rockefeller and the, you got money, man, in the hands of a very few people. And where did they get it? Well, they extracted it from the working class. And while we don't have company towns per se, while we don't have, you know, company script to pay people with per se, is it all that much different when your house is owned by the bank, where you're using everything? There's Citibank holds your paycheck. And if you lose that job, it's just different entities that come and throw you into the street. Where if bad things happen, tragedy strikes, your life is thrown into chaos. Something that I know a little bit about right now. Our history is full of these stories. Labor's history is rich with the blood of true working class heroes and patriots who simply wanted to be able to feed their families and leave something better for their children. Ask any working person today. The goals are the same. Want to keep a roof over the kids' head, put some food on the table, clothes on their backs, give them an opportunity for a future that we did not have. That's not unique to us in this moment. That's humanity. And I go back to those stories that my grandfather told of, yeah, they came back from World War II. Some of them came back from World War I. And they knew a thing or two. And they weren't going to take it. But I think this story, and I hope folks will take a look at it. This story, a little different. The story of organizing, yes, and the machinations of ideas and ideology and all of the intricacies of how this stuff works, but also the political power that has to come from this. And it's the thing that Donald Trump is fighting the hardest right now. The political power, the empowerment of organized workers to demand, I want better health care, I want better retirement, I want higher wages, I want to be able to, I don't know, put food on the table, a roof over their head, clothes on their backs. And if they get sick, I don't want to have to worry about going bankrupt. That has to be crushed out of us. That has to be snuffed away. Because the wealth class has always wanted compliant, desperate, pliable workers. Exploitable. You know, like it was in the Golden Age. Like it was for the Gilded Years where we had our wealthy rubbing our nose in it. Question is, how long will we put up with this charade? Because I'm dumbfounded most of the time when a working person tells me that Donald Trump cares about them. I'm dumbfounded when a working person who's barely making ends meet looks at Doge Boy and says, yep, Elon Musk's got my interests at heart. Yeah, I'm struggling with that. Now I wonder, and again, I wish we could have a time machine to go back. I gotta wonder how many people of the day thought, you know, the Vanderbilts or Carnegie or Rockefellers were the saints and the heroes of the day. I don't know. I'm sure there were some. But given today's mass media, given today's social media, given the opioid that we stick in our eyes every day by looking at this nonsense candy. I don't know. The country I thought we're not. The people I thought we were collectively, we're not. Individually, you know, look, I love my neighbors. I love people who reach a helping hand out to each other. But you do that mostly individually. When we get into groups, I don't know. I'm struggling with that in this moment. I see some good. I see people showing up and saying we want to defend democracy, and that's helpful. We need more of it. But out of this, we've got to grow some leaders, and with them, got to grow some stones. And we've got to take this bull by the horns, and we've got to fight back. Want to hear your thoughts. What are you doing? What's the plan? I've had a lot of people say, I'm just ducking and covering. I don't think that's the answer. I think we got to run face first into this. But I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Miss any portion of the program, grab the podcast. Freespeech.org. That's where you'll find our TV work. And for our TV audience, on Monday, we will be we'll be at a new time, 3 p.m. Eastern time. We're moving from 5 to 3. Looking forward to that. As always, thanks so much for being here. We'll see you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. Email Rick at rick@thericksmithshow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
This is locally grown radio.
WFHR 1320 AM. W248DE Wisconsin Rapids.
And always streaming on the Civic Media app.
This is CBS News on the Hour, sponsored by O'Reilly Auto Parts.
I'm Jennifer Kuiper. The president urges China to make a deal to end major trade tariffs. CBS's Linda Kenyon.
China has called President Trump's trade practices bullying and blackmail. The president acknowledges his tariffs of 145% against Chinese products are very high, but he says they don't have to stay that way.
I get along very well with President Xi. I hope we can make a deal. Otherwise, we'll set a price, and hopefully they'll come here and they'll contribute. And if they don't, that's okay.
In a much more easy going tone than when he set the tariffs, Trump conveyed a certain optimism.
We're going to get along great with China, I have no doubt about it.
Linda Kenyon, CBS News, the White House.
President Trump says when it comes to Russia's war in Ukraine, he thinks there is a deal with Russia, but...
I have to get a deal with Zelensky, and I hope that Zelensky... I thought it might be easier to deal with Zelensky. So far, it's been harder.
Trump blasted Ukraine's president on social media today for saying...